May it please the court, I think to understand this case, it's important to focus on why the town of South Pattern enacted this entire ordinance. And that was that the goal was something new, to responsibly integrate food trucks into the food service business inside the city in a way that was safe to the public, would prevent disease spreading, protect the environment, and fit within the community. Two things.
Can I ask you one thing real quick? Because I couldn't tell for sure. The original ordinance that was enacted without the restaurant preference authorization, was that ever put into use before it was changed?
No, that was a proposal which was never adopted.
Okay.
That was in 2015.
Okay.
And it got sent to the drawing board and came out as the one, as the genesis of what they're challenging. But in 2016, what we adopted was a pilot program that would be adjusted and evaluated as progressed, because we were concerned that this had to be integrated into the city at our pace, not at somebody else's pace. Now, questions permitting, I want to address two issues. First, standing. And the second is why they have failed to plead or offer proof that they have a claim of, under due course of law, for deprivation of what is, I guess the trade name is, an occupational liberty interest. Two things about the facts I want to clean up. First is, there is no permission scheme. The statute says that the local restaurant is supposed to support and sign, not permit. And this is important because we adopted the Texas Food Establishment Rules, which are the state rules for everybody, all kinds of food establishments, including food trucks. And they require food trucks to operate from what's called a central preparation facility or a commissary, the only one of which in Cameron County is in Harlingen.
You were talking about the rules, TFER rules.
Correct.
So you're saying that the permission scheme is not in addition? Because don't they have to abide by TFER anyway?
Yes, and that's my point, is that because we adopted both the food rules and our ordinance, common sense said that we had to make them an alternative. Because otherwise, if you didn't apply common sense, they would have to be associated with the commissary, which is in Harlingen, and they would have to work from a restaurant. So we made them an alternative. And that's
Have to do both anyway? Because don't they have to comply with both statutes, both the state regulations and now the city ordinance?
The food rules allow us to amend or change the food rules. Now, what we've done is simply create an alternative. They can either use the support on the island, or they can go to the one on the mainland. I think you know which one they'll probably pick. And that's how we interpret it.
If you read the code, the SPI code, it doesn't say anything about an alternative. I guess my question is, how would somebody that wants to open up one of these food trucks, how would they know, oh, well, I can go look at the TFER and maybe they're trying to say it's not, I mean, there's no way anybody would know that it's alternative.
Well, understand, but they can ask us. And people, as we pointed out in our brief, at least one instance, somebody came in and they already had a CPI elsewhere, and they got a permit.
Was that the Bill Miller people?
Yes.
And my understanding, there's no record of Bill Miller ever having a permit for a food truck.
Incorrect, Your Honor. I pointed that out in our reply brief, where in the record, they offered it. Uh-huh. It was one of their exhibits. So they did get a permit based on that.
Okay, Mr. Hughes, now I've confused. So I've become confused, which is not unusual, but so I thought that besides the state regulations, if you were going to get a food truck, besides the state regulations, you also had to comply with the city code, correct? I mean, there are two codes. I got to comply with both before I can get a permit.
Yes, but as a matter of common sense, we've chosen to interpret our code to say you can do one or the other.
Is there anywhere in the code written like a handbook that says, in interpreting our rules, this is what it actually means, I guess would be my question.
If your answer is, do we publish that, or
right.
I'm not aware of any, and it's certainly not in the record.
Thank
but
you.
As our representative, Mr. Baldovino, said, if Ms. Lerma had talked to us about it, she would have been told, but she got upset that her application was being denied for a variety of reasons and just withdrew it.
Would it be safe to say that if someone went to the code wouldn't have any other additional information as well? In other words, if I'm just, Jane Doe, and I want to go out and put a food truck on the island, I'll just look at the code and say what the code requires, and the code requires I need to have a local sponsor.
The code says we adopt the food rules, and then in the next section, it talks about local support. So you wouldn't, in one sense, you are put on notice that to look at the food rules. And like I said, as a matter of common sense, there's no sense in making people have a CPF and be supported by a local restaurant, because they're both food establishments that are permitted under the state code, they're going to have to offer the same services. So that only makes sense that they get the service from one facility or the other, but not both at the same time.
But Mr. Hughes, I don't see anything in the code that says when you get this signature of a restaurateur that you're going to go to them for any sort of interaction, any sort of service. It doesn't talk about anything. It's just you need their signature and that's it.
No, the code says they have to have the support and the signature.
But
that's our code that says they have to have.
Yes, sir, it does. But I don't think that indicates that they need to go and, receive facility help from there or use their services, use their water, use their kitchen. It doesn't provide for any interaction between a local restaurant and this food unit for any purpose other than to get permission.
Well, again, this is a code for people in the food service business, and that's what support means. And our people say that's why we interpret it, and we check with the restaurants, that is, we check to make sure they have an agreement to give the support. It's not just, is there a signature? He said, I call the restaurants. So they're going to verify what kind of work they're going to have. And then because we also inspect the restaurants, we're going to know whether they're able to provide the support.
Do you think that the restaurants, or do you know if the restaurants are, in fact, asking for a percentage of profits or a fine in order to issue this authorization or the support?
I think there's nothing on the record about what is commonly negotiated on the island. I think some of the two owners, the food truck operators that did testify said there may be a fee, and that and not only that, the CPFs in other cities, when you associated with them, would ask for a fee. The only time I ever saw anything about the profit was Chile de Arvol, the Avalos, their food truck park entered into a lease with them in order to lease the space and provide services. I think in the last year they were there, not the first year, their lease, but the last one leased asked for 10% of their profits. But that's a matter of negotiation.
It just seems that, talking about common sense, that sometimes that when you read the statute, it just kind of hits you as first, well, if I'm a, whatever restaurant I am on the island, do I really want more competition from food trucks? And so I'm not going to give my support, and creating this atmosphere of protecting the local establishments as opposed to, and that's where I think the problem, the creation comes as to whether this is a violation as set forth by the plaintiff.
Well, if I may, remember we're talking about the statute as the code as a whole, the ordinance as a whole. The ordinance as a whole lets them in. And that was the purpose. The mayor and people on the commission says they're going to come in. We need to determine on what condition they're going to come in. So what they're doing, because the statute as a whole does exactly that, It gives them an opportunity to come in and compete. What they're doing is, and I hate using this kind of word, they're creating kind of a bogeyman or a chupacabra out of the people who came and spoke at all the meetings. And the reason that all that is relevant because twofold. Number one, the issue is, does the statute serve the public interest? The second is, at page 53 of their brief, they say, we do not argue that the city fathers who enacted this statute had any secret or illicit purpose. Well, if the statute on its face serves the public interest, and having some sort of food rules to protect people and enforce them is in the public interest, and the city fathers who created the statute had no secret or illicit purpose, why are we questioning the statute? And there is no purpose, because if you're going to do that, then what you're going to do is pillory laws based on who spoke for or against them during the legislative process. And I might add, what's the difference? Because that's their real key problem that they're struggling with. If they strike down these provisions, they're going to have to go to a CPF. CPF basically provides the same service as a local food restaurant will provide. And they have effectively conceded that it's entirely appropriate that they be supported, that they'll live with the regulation. They don't challenge the regulation that says they're going to have to be supported on a daily basis by a central preparation facility. Now, as has been made clear throughout the record, restaurants can provide exactly the same service. So how is it that requiring them to go to a restaurant, which can and will provide the same service, doesn't serve the public interest when they concede that it's entirely appropriate that they go to some permitted facility? The second thing is, where is this all going to go? I pointed out.
Well, I want to take a step back, because always once I get into the weeds on one of these cases, as I was discussing with Justice Longoria, I step back and go, this is a denial of a plea to the jurisdiction, and so we're supposed to be reviewing de novo review. And so what are we supposed to be looking to ascertain whether the court was wrong in not granting your plea to the jurisdiction in a de novo review? Do we have to get down to the nitty-gritty of whether this statute is constitutional or not?
Well, the answer is twofold to that. Okay. First is the procedural one. The Supreme Court has made it clear that even though they're asking for a declaratory relief or injunctive relief, they at least have to plead facts establishing a cognizable constitutional claim. And I don't think they do that in this case, because the only occupational liberty interest that's been recognized is a prohibition or a restriction that prevents them from entirely performing their business anywhere in the state. That's not the case. And that was the Villarreal case recently, where they pointed out as being dismissed from school doesn't keep you from being a lawyer, because you can just go to another university, or you can come back and reapply in a year. The second one is, it gets into what kind of challenge.
But isn't Villarreal different? I remember reading Villarreal, and isn't it different because they're just trying to get a law degree, which you could get a license anywhere in the state of Texas, as opposed to here where basically they can't go get a permit anywhere else to open up a food truck on the SPID on the island?
Well, again, no, I think it is comparable. Okay. Because they can go to the county and operate outside the county, just so like Mr. Villarreal could go to another law school, get his degree there. He could go into another city. They could go to another county and practice.
But what if the question is, is it unconstitutional to prohibit somebody from having a mobile food unit on South Padre Island unless you have a sponsor from that city? Because that's the way the code reads. I understand your argument, but on its face, it just seems like that's what it's saying.
Well, it says support and a signature, the court is required to accept our explanation and interpretation of the ordinance because it's a plausible one. And it makes sense. I mean, that would be the only reason, the only sensible solution is to interpret that support means exactly what the position we have taken, and we enforce it to be.
Mr. Hughes, I was just curious, because I know you amended the statute to move the number of permissible trucks up to 18.
Correct.
But at the same time, I mean, if you knew there was some ambiguity about this C3 section, why didn't you amend it at that time to make it clear?
I can't answer that. That's not in the record, and I wasn't part of the process.
I understand. I was just curious.
And unless there are some questions, I will reserve the rest of my comments for the end and ask the court reverse in the order that our plea to the jurisdiction be granted.
Any questions from the council? You okay? All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Arif Punji with the Institute for Justice on behalf of the Food Truck Appellees. May it please the court. The City of South Padre Island's ordinances are not immune from the Texas Constitution, and when it enforces restrictions that condition the ability to vend on the island on whether you get a local restaurant to make you eligible or by capping permits to make the permits scarce, those are actual restrictions on the ability to vend on the island. The district court had months to deliberate these questions and correctly rejected the city's meritless jurisdictional arguments by applying binding precedent from the Texas Supreme Court. The clearest path to affirmance is to do the same here, Your Honors. We're here up on a plea to the jurisdiction, as Justice Benavidez correctly noted. And in the second plea to the jurisdiction, the city raises two jurisdictional issues, and I'll address each in turn. That's sovereign immunity and standing. The city also attempts to implicitly argue that there's an implicit denial of their first plea to the jurisdiction. That's an issue involving immunity from liability. I'll explain in my presentation why that's not jurisdictional. It's not properly before the court. So first, sovereign immunity. The Texas Supreme Court has been clear that when you're asking for a declaration of your constitutional rights, invoking your right under Article 1, and here Article 1, Section 19, there is no immunity if you're seeking equitable remedies like a declaratory judgment of your constitutional rights. Here's what the court said in Patel v. Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation. Quote, sovereign immunity is inapplicable, period, end quote. That's at 469 Southwest 3rd, 69. The pin site to that holding is on page 76 of the opinion. And the court explains, quite logically, that governments can immunize themselves, quote unquote, from the lawsuits that challenge the validity of their own enactments. And that makes sense, because from a doctrinal matter, the Constitution is a supreme law, and there is no immunity from that document. Turning to the UDJA, which we also invoke to get our declaratory judgment, we're challenging the validity of an ordinance, and the Texas Supreme Court has been clear on that point. There is no immunity there either. That case is Town of Shady Shores v. Swanson. It's at 590 Southwest 3rd, 544. The pin site is 552.
I was under the impression, and maybe I'm wrong, that the court denied your DAC action or did not rule on it?
The court fully granted our motion for summary judgment. It entered an order granting plaintiff's motion for summary judgment.
But not the DAC action?
Our motion for summary judgment was on all the merits, following the close of discovery, on full briefing on summary judgment. And so we're moving on our claim, both seeking a declaratory judgment, a permanent injunction if the laws are declared unconstitutional, and a dollar in nominal damages.
So Mr. Hughes just argued that you cannot recover on the declarant judgment because you don't have a cognizable cause of action of an economic damage, because it says, well, you can go up in a food court anywhere else in the state of Texas, just like they did in the Very Out case at the Texas Supreme Court. It's true. As a matter of fact, I think what in your brief you acknowledge that you are operating in county lines, if not within the city limits.
You're correct, Your Honor. Our client, Surfive, tried to operate a food truck on South Padre Island. In April 2018, there were no permits. She went and got a permit on county land. But the city's ordinances, much like the county's laws, much like any city's ordinances in the Rio Grande Valley, have to be constitutional. The city doesn't get to say, well, we have these laws, but because you can just operate your food truck down in McAllen or Edinburgh, no judicial review. The Supreme Court has been clear, also in Patel, and that's at page 77 of the opinion, that to have a viable claim under the Texas Constitution, you need to plead a viable claim. You don't have to prove the claim. You get to prove that later. We did that, and we prevailed. But for matters of jurisdiction, at the base of the petition, we have to plead a viable claim. And we don't dispute that. We direct the court to Clerk's Record 22 to 24, where we do exactly that. We plead that the laws that we're challenging in this case have no legitimate governmental interests that support them. That means they're invalid on their face. We also plead that There's no logical means ends fit between the laws we're challenging and a legitimate governmental interest. We then plead under Patel that the actual real world effect, quote unquote, of the laws are not connected to any legitimate governmental interest. And then finally, we plead that the laws are so burdensome as to be unconstitutionally oppressive. And that's the part of the burden inquiry under Patel. And that's at 22 to 44. So we have a viable claim. We get to prove that claim. For purposes of jurisdiction, that's all we need. To address Your Honor's point on the liberty interest, now the city tries to run away from Patel because it's a reality-based test. What the Texas Supreme Court did in Patel is something doctrinally significant and really reflects the heavy lifting that judges sometimes have to do. It pronounced that under the due course of law clause, after delving into the history of the law, of the clause in our current Constitution and going through prior versions of it, that it protects more rights than the federal Constitution's 14th Amendment, because it was added to our Constitution after the Slaughterhouse cases eviscerated the Privileges or Immunities Clause in the federal 14th Amendment. It then marshals its energy towards figuring out what's the test, because Texas courts have applied different tests. And here's what the court says. Quote, this is at page 86 of the opinion, and I think this reveals what they're going after, and that is, this is a test that's going to govern challenges under the due course of law clause to laws that regulate, quote, economic interests. The court says, quote, as the parties to this case and numerous Texas courts and commentators have pointed out, the answer to that has not been made clear as to substantive due process challenges to government regulation of economic interest, period, end quote. And so the Patel framework in terms of the test that courts apply on the merits is a test that applies to challenges to economic regulations. And we'd point the court to a series of cases that the Texas Supreme Court marches through that regulate involve challenges to all sorts of regulations, the placement of railroad tracks, prohibiting people from helping folks buy eyeglasses, property rights cases. Here, Your Honor, we have regulations.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's the very crux of the issue as far as sometimes I get kind of confused because, I mean, the way I see Patel is that once the city can say, you know, demonstrate some sort of, you know, legitimate government interest, which they have given several reasons why this regulation could be important, that's done. Is that not the way it is?
No, Your Honor. The government can't just defeat jurisdiction by throwing up against the wall legitimate governmental interests. They get to defend the law on the merits by putting forth some governmental interests, and then we get to use evidence to undermine them and show that we prevail on the merits. Here we're at the jurisdictional stage. Our job is to plead a viable claim in our petition. We've done that. And our job is to show that sovereign immunity doesn't apply, and we've done that. And so that's why the court then pivots and says you have to plead and prove your claim, and throws a bunch of cases involving waiving sovereign immunity. In some of those cases, you have to go through the merits, Your Honor, and that's because to unlock the waiver, you need to show that there's a violation of a statute under the statute that you're suing under. And sometimes, as the court has explained, you have to go through the merits to see if there's a violation to unlock the key to waiver. There is no waiver here.
Okay, so that's where I get crux tonight. So in order to ascertain whether you have a valid claim and a waiver of the denial of clear jurisdiction, you have to claim a viable cause of action. And we've always talked about, it used to be we would just take the pleadings, and now the Supreme Court in it has said, well, sometimes you have to look at the underlying merits of the case. And do we have to get to the issue as to whether the statute is unconstitutional or not in order to ascertain whether the plea was properly denied?
No, Your Honor. You only have to do that if you have to waive immunity. In all the cases the city cites involving tort statutes, or you can look at whistleblower acts, if those statutes have a waiver built into the statute, the jurisdictional inquiry will be, well, is there a violation of the statute? And then you have to sometimes go through merits facts to find the jurisdictional answer. This is not that type of case, because the Texas Supreme Court made clear in Patel that there is no immunity to waive when you're bringing a declaratory judgment action seeking equitable remedies. Our clients are only asking for a declaration of their constitutional rights. And there is no immunity there, because there is no immunity from Article 1, Section 19 in the first instance. Which is why at page 77 of the Patel opinion, when the court addresses viability, it says exactly that. So we'd ask the court to apply Patel based on its clear holding there.
Does it matter that you're asking for a nominal damage of a dollar?
No, Your Honor, and that's where I will go next.
Okay.
And thanks for that question. Nominal damages, as the Texas Supreme Court has made clear, involves immunity from liability. The city argues it doesn't have to pay compensatory damages and tries to add nominal damages into those holdings. Nominal damages, though, It's not jurisdictional. Here's what the court said in State v. Lueck. Quote, immunity from liability is an affirmative defense that cannot be raised by a plea to the jurisdiction, period, end quote. So the city has a vehicle problem on the nominal damages question. It can fight about it by getting a ruling on its affirmative defense, not here a jurisdiction. State v. Lueck is discussed on page 28 of our response brief. It's at 290 Southwest 3rd, 876. The holding is 880. And the city in its reply claims that we don't have any authority to offer on the nominal damages point. It makes no effort to address State v. Lueck. It makes no effort to even cite it. But ignoring binding precedent does not make it go away. So on jurisdiction, Your Honor, there is no immunity. We have pled a viable claim, and we direct the court to the face of our petition, clerk's record 22 to 24 specifically. And on nominal damages, there's a vehicle problem. It can't be raised here because it's not jurisdictional, and this appeal is confined to jurisdiction. Turning to standing. Standing is the other flavor of jurisdictional argument that the court advances here to claim that we don't have a feet to stand on to bring our claim. The city is wrong. Our clients have food trucks. They looked for a permit. There was none when they first got their food truck, so they went elsewhere. The city then reaches out to Sur 5 and says, there's permits now. You should come apply within the city limits if you want to operate. Sur 5 applies. City Hall gets summoned to City Hall, and the permitting official says the following. You don't have a local license establishment that signed your permit application. Let's stop right there. That's because the restaurant permission scheme is an eligibility requirement. It requires a signature on an application, quote, to be eligible for a permit. Those final six words are part of the one sentence restriction. You'll find those six words nowhere in the city's briefing, and they're two briefs in. It's an eligibility restriction. Now, Sur 5's been injured. It's been caused by the regulations we're challenging.
Mr. Hughes argues this morning that in reading the totality of the code along with the food services code, that common sense makes it, well, as long as you have compliance under the state food laws, whatever the acronym is for that this morning, that would be sufficient. And so you don't need, I mean, it seemed that's what he was arguing to us this morning.
I think the city's wrong. At first, the TFER, the Texas Food Establishment Rules provision TFER. That they're referencing, they're referencing a central preparation facility base of operations rule. So they don't correctly describe the rule. It's a state of Texas rule that says if you operate a food truck, you have to base your operations from a central preparation facility. That can be a commissary, that can be a licensed restaurant, anywhere that's convenient for you, not just on South Padre Island.
And my understanding from the rules is that's so that they have a facility somewhere to get rid of, like, the waste, the oil that needs to be properly discarded and just can't be dumped in a dumpster.
You're correct, Your Honor. Like, the Avalos brothers were at a food truck park. They dispose of their gray water at the food truck park. They'd want to go then vent on Padre and come back to their base of operations. The city mischaracterizes the TFER rule by saying, well, it's just a commissary and there's only one, otherwise we have this alternative. So if we just pause right here and take a look, the TFER regulates how you operate your food truck. The restaurant permission regulates who is eligible for a permit. It's a pre-application condition which lets local restaurant owners determine who's eligible, which is why the city concedes this on page 11 of its brief when it says about Sur 5's application, quote, the application was incomplete because it was not signed by a local licensed food establishment, period, end quote. Now, I'd point your honors to this. This argument is really a post hoc justification that came out after we sued them. And one way to easily come to that conclusion is the Bill Miller barbecue permit. Bill Miller barbecue was never issued a food truck permit. That's why there's no food truck permit in the record. And we point that out in our response brief. The city finally attaches this permit and application with a reply brief. The reply brief is a 90-page filing, and I direct the court to page 86 and 88 of the reply brief filing. Page 86 is the application for Bill Miller Barbecue's temporary permit. Temporary permits are not even subject to the laws we're challenging in this case. It's for a catering job on Padre Island. They issue dozens of temporary permits. And on page 88, and one thing I should point out, on page 86, there's not even the box for the local restaurant owner to sign off on that application. Unlike the series of permit applications for food trucks that are in the record, each of which contains a local restaurant owner's permission. And on page 88 of the reply brief, you see Bill Miller Barbecue's permit for the first time. Big bold letters, temporary permit, right below it, catering. It's not a food truck permit, it's immaterial, and that's the only evidence they could point to try to button up their post hoc justification. The bottom line here is the restaurant permission scheme is an eligibility restriction. The city will not even process your application until a local licensed restaurant owner signs off on it. And that's why the plain reading of the rule makes it common sense to people to think that the government means what it says when it says you have to get a signature to be eligible. If you want to look into the TFIR, that's an operation requirement. You don't even get there until you're permitted and inspected. These are two different restrictions, and they're not alternatives to each other on their face or in practice.
Before you leave standing, Mr. Panju, I remember reading in the brief where they argue standing that you're not eligible due to the fact that you were, that the permit was never denied because they couldn't receive that support, and or the original denial. That one was that the application didn't have the proper signature, and in the second one, Mr. Avalos, I believe, never even applied for a permit and was denied one.
So the city's playing word games that they don't deny. You're not even eligible, and that's what they told Survive after summoning Survive to City Hall after they had applied. For purposes of standing,
so they didn't even accept the application. Is that what you're telling the
court? They accepted it, looked at it, and then called Survive to come down to City Hall. I think I direct the court to Clerk's Record 2743, where the city's permitting official reaches out to Survive and says, we have permits now. That's because the city knew that it didn't have a permit. And then they applied. And then the city says on page 11 of its opening brief that the application was incomplete because it wasn't signed by a restaurant owner. They refused to process it. Denied, no permit haver, just fencing them out. The bottom line for standing, Your Honor, is that there's injury here, there's causation, and that's what we need for standing. Survive has run into the permit cap, there was no permits, the city reached out and said, apply, Survive applied, they wouldn't process the application, again, because of the restaurant scheme. That's all we need for standing, Your Honor, and jurisdiction is simple.
Counselor, if you have, assuming, for the sake of argument, you have standing for Survive, do you have standing for Avalos because of that, because they're asking for the same relief? What is your standing argument with regard to the Avalos plaintiffs?
Justice Longoria, you're correct. Once one plaintiff has standing, you don't have to go into the inquiry for the second. But Avalos Brothers have standing in their own right. The city argues that they're just no different than members of the public. Well, Patel says on page 77 of the opinion when it discusses standing that you need an actual or threatened restriction, and you have to allege it's unconstitutional. The Avalos Brothers aren't just members of the public. They, like Survive, have scouted vending locations on South Padre Island. Survive applied. The Avalos Brothers brought their food truck there to vend at an event to test out the market. They actually have a food truck business. They've looked at the regulations, and the regulations apply to them. They don't just apply to them because they show up and apply. They apply to them because they have food truck businesses. They've gone there and tried to figure out a way to make it work, and they've been fenced out.
That the city brings up the fact that the Avalos Brothers, in fact, don't have food trucks anymore today. They've closed them down, and that apparently appeared in Facebook.
Your Honors, I think asking about the post-record, after-the-fact Facebook post that the Avalos Brothers put and said we're closed. Well, we direct the court to the mandamus briefing and the mandamus record, which explains why that is. After the Avalos Brothers won at summary judgment, their lease was terminating with a broken sprocket in Brownsville, and they were finally ready to go on Padre because they had just won their case. And then they got fenced out, so they no longer had the food truck lease, and then they had to set up a new vending location. They said, you know, we're going to close this right now. We're teachers, and we're going to wait for the case to finish. And that's what the mandamus petition explains. And if the court looks to the Facebook post, we would ask that the court take judicial notice of the mandamus briefing where the Avalos Brothers explain why they've been injured, specifically because the city continues enforcing the very laws that have been injuring them and Survive. So, Your Honor, to wrap it up, Your Honor, sovereign immunity is simple. There is no sovereign immunity in these types of cases. Nominal damages is simple. It's not jurisdictional. These are clear, direct holdings from the high court. And standing is simple. If we just look at Survive, for example, or even the Avalos Brothers, these are laws that apply to them. These are laws that restrict them. And they've challenged the constitutionality of the laws. Under clear holdings in Patel on standing, on sovereign immunity, on viability, there is jurisdiction. And we ask this court to affirm the denial of the plea and send us back to the district court for what very little there is remaining to do there in that court.
Thank you.
Questions permitting, I'd like to return to a subject about why there's no difference about our support requirement and what's required of a CPF. Aside from the fact the law requires our construction to be accepted if it's plausible, look at what TFIR says about essential preparation facilities, and that's a 221 228.21 subsection B. It first says, mobile food units shall operate from a central preparation facility and to shall report to such location daily for supplies and cleaning. That doesn't say much more than what ours does. The second thing is, and this is where I disagree with what council said, central preparation facilities have to meet particular standards, because then it goes on to say, the central preparation facility or other fixed food service establishment used as a base of operation for mobile food units shall be constructed and operated with the requirements of subchapter F. And they have extensive provisions in subchapter F and the other provisions about how they're to be constructed and how they're to be operated. So once again, I say when our regulation says support, that's about just about as specific as the TEFR rule, and we interpret them to basically require the same. Now, let me get back to the standing, and I have to make some factual differences of what council represented. First, as to Chile de Arbolos, their lease was up in December after the court signed the order. That's what council's true. They moved to another location in Brownsville, and that's in the their own Facebook page, which we offered into the record. It was from the second location in Brownsville that they decided to close their business. Nothing to do with the fact they couldn't get in Brownsville. As for Cert 5, they had three reasons, and we were clear, and they were all true if you look at their application. First, both TEFR and our rules say you have to have a certified food manager. Well, they didn't provide any proof they had a certified food manager on staff. Maybe they could have provided that later, but it wasn't there the day they brought it in. The second one was our rule requires that you have an agreement from somebody, a private lot owner, in the area zone for food trucks that you can park your truck there. It has nothing to do with a restaurant. It can be a strip mall owner. It can be a t-shirt shop, but you have to have permission from the lot owner to park your truck there. They didn't have that, and she admitted in her deposition. She got the area wrong. She went to a strip mall that wasn't located in there, and that she thought that was enough. So they had three rule things that they that knocked them out, and they never bothered to say, oh yeah, we finally found somebody in the proper zone, etc. They haven't cured that at all. Now, going back to the question about standing, in Patel, there were two challenges, a facial challenge and as an applied challenge. And the Supreme Court said, as to the facial challenge, because on its face there is a plausible reason that this requirement for all these hours is reasonable and necessary because they can give a plausible reason, you lose. You haven't even pled it. Then they turn to the as-applied challenge, and that's critical because in an in-applied, as-applied challenge, it's not only evidentiary. An as-applied challenge under cold Texas law says you have to concede that this will apply constitutionally to some people, just not you in your particular situation. So they would have the burden to say this ordinance could apply constitutionally to some food trucks, but for some reason it just shouldn't apply to us. And in Patel, they had a reason, because these general cosmetology licenses that they had to have, these were across the board for all kind of cosmetology people. But hair threaders, but they was established that number one, the licensing department of the state could only justify 5 hours as even remotely applicable to eyebrow threaders. The other, I think 745, they couldn't justify at all. The second thing was, and this is what's missing in their case, the hair threader said, if I have to take those courses I don't need, it'll cost me thousands. And perhaps council will spell me, but I think the figure was either $3,000 to $5,000 to take all these unnecessary courses, or $5,000 to $7,000. That's not in the record because these people never bothered to try to find out what it was going to real work cost to get local support from a restaurant. There's nothing about that. And the people who did give evidence said, it's easy and it's not so expensive. And it's certainly no expensive than getting it from a central preparation facility. The red light's blinking, and unless there are questions.
Any questions, Justin McGurk? Nope, that'll be it.
Thank